and welcome to the Fall 2006 edition of CNS News. I'm Pauline Bartoloni.
And I'm Larry Santana, and today we'll be bringing you stories from around the Bay Area, produced by students from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism.
We'll also hear the stories behind the stories, directly from the producers themselves. But first, Davina Attar has the headlines.
We begin with a story that unites small-town politics and a national debate. The Iraq War has sparked conflict across the country, including how to honor American war casualties. In the East Bay town of Lafayette, R. Nick Bonovich found that debate is driving a clash between freedom of speech and city regulations.
Hundreds of crosses and a large sign signifying the almost 3,000 servicemen and women who have died in Iraq fill a hillside across from the BART station. When the project turned controversial, the city council heard from both opponents and supporters.
One of those crosses has my son's name on it. My view of honoring my son agrees with this project, and I stand up for it.
But some members of the community view the display as a subliminal attack against the Iraq War and U.S. troops.
This is an anti-war, anti-military in disguise as being a tribute or memorial.
The real story here isn't the crosses of Lafayette, but the large sign that violates the city's sign ordinance. The sign is about 65 square feet, and in residential areas, a sign must be no larger than 4 square feet.
Mayor Ivor Sampson says it's about zoning, not free speech.
We can't regulate and have no desire to regulate what it says, what the content is, but we are concerned about the size. And a big sign that said, "I love Mom," would be equally in violation of the sign ordinance.
So the council directed the city attorney to review the matter only as it affects the sign. No matter what happens to the sign, the crosses representing the Americans dead in Iraq will stay. This is Nick Bonovich for CNS News.
Closer to the Bay, residents are flocking to a new library. With locals signing up for library cards at a record rate, reporter Dwayne Moles says it's not just having a new place to read or surf the web that has them excited.
With small town fanfare, Alamedans celebrated the construction of a new city library. It's the first in over 100 years and the first green building in town. Green technology permeates the library, from the recycled steel used to frame the structure to the ecologically harvested wood for the bookshelves.
Since the eco-friendly nature of many of these features might go unnoticed, designers left a little reminder that green building comes in many shades. Through this window, patrons can see the innovative insulation, recycled, shredded blue jeans.
The new library is the first building in the city with the potential to earn a Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED certification, the national benchmark for building green. But that can only happen after it's inspected and approved. City officials will stay green to the end. When they file their final LEED application next week, they'll save a few trees by submitting everything electronically. This is Dwayne Moles for CNS News.
On the UC campus, a grove of live oaks just outside Memorial Stadium stands in the path of a university development project.
For weeks, environmental activists have mounted a grassroots protest on campus, in the grove, and even up in the trees.
This is just one small symptom of the overall larger problem of the university not taking into consideration environmental concerns when they're developing buildings.
Some of the oaks are over 100 years old. Tree sitters and the Save the Oaks Coalition said they'll remain. Berkeley's Mayor Tom Bates said the city will sue UC Regents.
Inside Memorial Stadium, the Cal football team wrapped up its season with a win over Bay Area rival Stanford. Despite the victory, reporter Clayton Warfolk says some Bear fans have mixed feelings about a season that began with national title hopes.
Over 70,000 fans flocked to Memorial Stadium on Saturday to watch Cal square off with Stanford in the 109th annual big game.
Big game, go Bears, right here!
The 21st-ranked Bears defeated the Cardinal 26-17 for their fifth straight big game win. The victory capped off a season in which Cal went 9-3, undefeated at home, and earned a program-best fourth straight bowl bid. But back-to-back losses late in the season crushed Cal fans' hopes of returning to the Rose Bowl for the first time since 1959. Coach Jeff Tedford described the season as highly emotional.
Well, we're disappointed that we didn't win the conference or go to the Rose Bowl and those type of things. I'm still very, very proud of this team.
Al Bears, you feel me?
For the fans, a win against Stanford and a trip to the Holiday Bowl later this month will suffice. This is Clayton Warfolk for CNS News.
With the Cal victory and an upset by UCLA over powerhouse USC, the Bears earned a share of the conference title for the first time since 1975. That's it for headlines. I'm Davina Attar. Back to you, Larry and Pauline.
Just 8 miles from the UC Berkeley campus is California's most dangerous city.
So far this year, Richmond has had 40 homicides, and residents are fed up. For a month this fall, they turned a parking lot into a tent city, a movement that has touched many in the Bay Area. Sean Anderson reports.
For many in Richmond, it's been a tough year. Former gang member Freddie Jackson realized he'd had enough after violence erupted during a memorial service.
And when the shooting happened inside the funeral home, that's when I got on the phone and started calling the community leaders that could help me try to bring some of this violence to an end.
One of those leaders was Reverend Andre Shoemake. He emphasized a new approach.
If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten.
So they took a page from the civil rights era sit-ins. Residents began camping in the very same areas where the homicides occurred. They called it Tent City.
We've come together here in Tent City to draw attention to the issue, because unless we realize that we are a city that is sick with homicides, then the healing would never begin.
The makeshift collection of picnic tables and tents became a gathering place for concerned citizens.
Right on, man.
Donations sustained the effort. The camp became an unofficial forum for the anti-violence effort.
But like you said, you have to have a plan after this. After this, what's next? I'm saying we have to get jobs for the kids, some kind of programs.
City officials granted organizers a 30-day permit to remain in the park. Tent City expanded to 3 other locations in Richmond.
We had no inclination that it would take off as it has.
In the 6 weeks the residents camped out, there were 2 homicides, far below the average rate. But one of those homicides occurred just blocks away from the original Tent City.
We'll never be able to stop all the homicides, but we want to curb them down very low.
That may seem like a defeat, but for those so accustomed to violence, at least it's a start. This is Sean Aronson for CNS News.
Over the only thing you really were hearing about Richmond was the homicides. And this was a story where people were just sick of waiting on the police, and then decided to do something for themselves.
A shopkeeper across the street told us a bunch of things off the record in terms of how violence has affected his life and his business. Showed me bullet holes in the walls. Talked about how once Tent City was taken down, things would go back to normal, i.e. more violence.
Back in Berkeley, more and more students are exploring the Islamic faith, and some have already converted. Sonia Narang has a story.
I'll come over and give you a hijab.
The Muslim Students Association at UC Berkeley is one of the most active student groups on campus. It draws young people of all backgrounds. Adina Bohanic, a 21-year-old student, says her experience living in Egypt exposed her to the religion.
With the influences from these people and also being in this country and experiencing the religion firsthand and realizing its beauty and how misunderstood it was, it had a big impact on me at the time.
3 years ago, after she married an Egyptian, she converted to Islam.
Before I converted, I guess I was kind of this wild, you know, aimless, like, teenager. It's just being more conscientious about what you're doing and your actions.
Every fall, Muslim students at UC Berkeley celebrate the holy month of Ramadan together. They gather at Julie's Cafe on Bancroft to feast on food, meet friends, and chat about the day's events. Students are increasingly embracing Islam.
The interesting thing is, why would they choose to go back to a tradition that at this point is really in a very difficult situation? It's not, you're not joining the Sierra Club.
For Roberta Davenport, a 20-year-old Middle Eastern Studies major at Cal, it's been a gradual process since her conversion in high school.
When I started college, I started wearing the headscarf. It took a while after that for me to start, like, obviously praying 5 times a day, fasting during Ramadan.
The increasing interest in Islam may be an unintended consequence of the U.S.-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Young people in general are exploring, and Islam is one of those traditions that does offer an avenue for self-control, self-discipline.
That's what appealed to Adina Bohanic.
And I came a lot more focused on who I wanted to be and kind of trying to consciously choose what I did and didn't want in my life.
For many more young people on college campuses nationwide, Islam has become a way of life. This is Sonia Narang for CNS News.
On Thursday night, when most college kids, undergrads especially, are out partying and drinking, here were the students, the Muslim students, praying. When I went back subsequently and we sort of bonded, because we all come from that same cultural minority group, and you know, I don't know if that has anything to do with me feeling comfortable, but they certainly felt like they could talk to me.
Expensive campaign ads are common in every election year, but our Rob Krieger says some politicians are now reaching more voters for less money.
Our answer is America.
Since this first political spot in 1952, campaign ads have become big business. In 2006, candidates spent a record $2.5 billion.
It's tragic, and it's time for a change.
Have impact of ads on the race.
This is Chris Thomas of the PeopleChoose.org. It's a new website where voters can find information and see videos about candidates.
You know, right now there are very low barriers to getting onto the internet.
Because the People Choose is free, you don't have to be a millionaire to make your own political video commentary. And you can look at footage from across the country in one centrally located place.
You can go onto the map and you click on a map, you click on California, and boom, the three hottest races in California come up. And then video both the candidates' commercials and citizen commercials.
On election night, most voters watch this kind of coverage on TV.
Projected Bob Menendez, the incumbent Democrat, will win out over Tom Kane Jr.
But for Eric Eccles, the People Choose had something more compelling to offer.
What we've done is really taken the process of editing and made it useful not just to people using Final Cut, but now to the soccer mom, the photojournalist.
Or a beauty queen like Jan Coleman, a former Miss South Dakota. She produced her own spot for the People Choose.
I've never really been involved in politics, never really wanted to. But I just found that what's been going on in the country the last few years, I could no longer sit quietly and not speak out.
Just reflecting, for instance, on the role of women and the role that they...
And it was a good night for Patrick O'Heffernan, too.
Oh, great.
He's the president of the People Choose. Oh, yeah.
So far, we've had 891 people visit the site. They've downloaded 4,900 pages, and we've had 45,000 hits.
Although these numbers may not compare to TV, experts say that voters will continue to turn to the internet to watch and produce their own ads in the future. For CNS News, I'm Rob Krieger.
You thought gay marriage was pushing boundaries, but what about multiple partners? From TV sitcoms to the dating scene, people are looking for more than monogamy.
Love is the ultimate act of revolution, filled with...
Meet Wendy O'Matic, a self-proclaimed radical love warrior.
For the lover is a gift.
Wendy got her name during her punk rock days. Now she offers workshops at universities and activist centers like this one. She counsels people on polyamory, that is, how to be in multiple romantic relationships at the same time.
I'm talking about the freedom to love who you want, how you want, the way you want, and as many as you want.
A lot of people are in the closet, more in the closet about being polyamory or open love, open relationships, than they are about being bi or gay or trans.
That's why dozens of people attend her workshops every month. Wendy O'Matic says open relationships are becoming a trend.
Not a trendy thing, but a trend that's moving to being less in the taboo and more out in the public.
Dossie Easton is a therapist in San Francisco and author of the first book on polyamory. She says for centuries, humans have had non-monogamous tendencies, but face difficulties because it is socially forbidden.
It's something that everybody might experience, and again, everybody doesn't decide to act on it. Partly because everybody doesn't have the opportunities or the support systems to do it.
Non-monogamy is nothing new to Dawn and Aiken of San Leandro. They've had an open marriage for 9 years and now live with Leah.
We're actually really blessed living in the San Francisco Bay Area because there are more events than we can possibly go to.
Including events in their own backyard, Dawn and Aiken hold regular discussion groups and pool parties for polyamorous people.
It has brought a lot of different people into our lives.
Meanwhile, through her book and workshop, Wendy O'Matic continues to ask individuals to re-examine their relationships.
And to be honest with yourself and imagine that there isn't just one formula for everyone.
Wendy O'Matic says juggling relationships isn't for everyone. What's most important is that people find what's best for them.
And now for a different kind of juggling. Math and art don't always mix, but Fulvio Paolucci discovered some Stanford grad students that are using brain power to bring the two together.
Juggling has been entertaining crowds and kings since the beginning of recorded history. The ancient art survives today as a hobby for people all over the world. Here in Berkeley, there is an annual festival that draws hundreds of fans.
The artistic soul of juggling is the community.
That community includes artists, students, professionals, and some who just love it. Juggling is increasingly popular in the United States, but there are few formal ways to learn it.
Many agree the best schools of juggling are based in Europe, where the circus has a long tradition. But California is the place where jugglers are breaking new ground and are doing this with computers.
At Stanford, juggling is serious. Not a sport, not an art, but an exact science. Meet Nilfred Picciotto, Google engineer, Stanford graduate student, and juggling expert.
We're a group, we call ourselves the Stanford Juggling Research Institute. Pretty much every week we are coming up with new ideas, figuring out things that we've never done before, that we presume no one has done before in most cases, and sort of figuring out, well, what are the rules that we normally follow? Can we break that rule?
They can, and did, inventing the ultimate juggling pattern, codename LCM43, or CIMOL.
It forces one juggler to throw out of both hands at the same time to two different people, which we hadn't really done before. It took several tries before I could actually make my hands do it, because, you know, the muscle memory, you're not used to doing that, it's hard to do it the first time. But people who have heard about this pattern from other jugglers have come up to me and asked, can you show me the LCM43? And here comes
Samo. Juggling has gone digital, but remains a very human art. Even virtual reality calls for practice. In Stanford, this is Fulvio Paolucci for CNS News.
The Oakland homicide rate is at a 10-year high. This year alone, there have been over 140 of them. Our reporter Brian Pollack went to East Oakland. He talked to some people who are trying to knock out the problem before it begins.
Kids at the East Oakland Boxing Association have seen their share of violence.
I got a lot of friends who are in gangs, in a lot of gangs. I walk away from them. I ain't got to be in no gang. That's not my thing. You know what I'm saying?
Boxing is 18-year-old Daryl's thing since he first came to the gym and met coach and mentor Raul Lagura.
He comes from a broken home. He just recently left his house like a few months ago and decided to train really hard.
I had nothing to do, really, so I started coming down here and boxing. So this gave me something to do when I'm not at school or nothing.
Former Golden Gloves champ Stanley Garcia started the program because he knows what it's like. He grew up here in East Oakland.
There's more murders here. It's tough. These kids, it's tough on them. There's always somebody out there in a hustle.
But when kids like Daryl get hooked on boxing, there's no time for trouble. Their hours are spent practicing and building stamina.
When I first came here, I couldn't hit the speed bag. I couldn't hit the heavy bags. I couldn't jump rope. I couldn't do none of that. 2 weeks later, I was able to do all that.
But there's more to this gym than raw physical training. Coach Lagura sees the boys transform.
I've seen cases in which they are more confident and have more self-esteem in themselves, and I think that is taking them sort of out of the ghetto, you know.
So take that little step, jab, go to the right.
Fighting might seem a strange way to keep kids away from violence, but that is a matter of perspective.
I'd rather have them communicate through their fists in a controlled environment than picking up a gun and putting lead in each other.
A sentiment shared by all. This is Brian Pollack, CNS News, Oakland.
But one of the things that the coach Stanley Garcia told me at the end, I said, you know, hey, what are some of the success stories? Now, one of the stories that he said was about a guy who came back one day and he said, thanks, coach, you know, and Garcia was like, for what? He said, when I was in the joint, this place was the only thing that used to make me smile.
Almost every week, Bay Area kids gather to learn about a piece of history not many others know. And they have fun while doing it. So did our reporter, Taylor Pipes.
As the sun sets over San Francisco,
A ghost of Navy past lives on across the bay in Alameda. By day, the USS Hornet aircraft carrier is a museum, but by night, Boy Scouts from all over California spend the night there. Pillows, sleeping bags, and enough gear for a tour of duty fill the pier. First stop, up the planks into the ship for an orientation. Keith Ledoux organizes the overnights and first started working on the ship as a volunteer worker.
I came here in 1995 and signed up as a volunteer to help clean up the ship, be on display for a limited time before it was going to be sold for scrap. And so I was actually involved in forming the organization that saved the ship.
Yellow jackets peppered with badges signify tour docents that lead scouts across the ship. Allie Brown is one of them.
Being able to come down and spend the night on the ship is just a great opportunity. I wish it was there for me when I was younger, but, you know, I'm catching up now.
So far, 500,000 kids have spent the night on the Hornet. They learn its involvement in World War II and how the ship worked. Travis Wolf Penley learned how the jets take off.
There's this catapult that launches them.
But the program is more than just badges and tours. Any youth group can come and learn a forgotten time in our history.
Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Cub Scouts, we have 4-H, church groups, YMCA. I mean, any group that has youth, school groups, you come down and spend the night.
The night ends with ghost stories. The ship is rumored to be haunted, and the kids retire to their small bunks, just as they were in World War II. And organizers like Ledoux hope they will be a bit smarter about a little-known Bay Area monument when the lights go out. In Alameda, Taylor Pipes reporting for CNS News.
It's a pretty historic ship. It was involved in the Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 rescue missions. And it's sitting here in the Bay Area, kind of hidden away in Alameda. And come nightfall, these kids just love being on this ship. The part that I thought was the most difficult was trying to interview kids, keep them composed, ask interesting questions. It seems like a lot of questions you ask kids, they elicits a response, yes, no, awesome, and that's kind of it.
And now we'll look at how online dating is helping singles who are HIV positive meet each other. Adithia Sambamurthy has a story.
Diane Haddock of Santa Rosa says internet dating has changed her love life.
When the internet first came out, I think I was kind of afraid that people were going to find out who I was, where I lived, and that I had AIDS kind of thing. But then once I got into it.
What she got into was Paz Personals, a dating site for HIV-positive singles.
It's helping Paz people meet other positive people.
And it's helping Diane find romance. HIV dating sites such as Paz Match, HIV Net, and Paz Personals, which has 33,000 members, are increasingly attracting positive singles.
I've dated quite a few different people. I mean, I've flown all over the place and, you know, pretty much gotten to see the United States from the sites.
Not all positive singles share her experience. David Weinman, who has lived with the virus for more than 20 years, is a member of the HIV Prevention Planning Council. Weinman says HIV dating sites have little participation in San Francisco. He prefers sites where members share common interests.
It's so much easier to go to gayantiquecarcollectors.com and just say, hey, I drive a classic Buick and I'm HIV positive, live in San Francisco. Anyone want to take a ride?
Both Weinman and Haddock agree they've had some bad experiences dating HIV negative people who couldn't accept their positive status.
He stood up and got dressed and walked out. Said, I can't do this. I can't do this.
He basically just like lost all the color in his face and just didn't, like his smile just went away and he just turned around and walked away from me.
Despite the rejection, they continue to look for Mr. Right, each in their own way, and Diane remains committed to HIV positive websites.
I'm moving on again and looking again and pretty much, you know, seeing what else is out there. I'm going to jump right back in like everything else. I want somebody that's going to enjoy life as much as I do.
This is Aditya Sambamurthy for CNS News.
As far as misconceptions go, I didn't know anything about it. So other than, you know, my personal experience with one of my high school friends. But I knew nothing about it. You know, Diane, for example, who is sort of the protagonist in this little piece that I did, if I was to meet her on the street, I would have no idea. I mean, she's not shooting drugs, she's not doing, you know, she's not the kind of person that I would have thought would have been contracting HIV, so.
When Cody's bookstore closed this summer, people worried about the future of Telegraph Avenue. The city has a plan, but Clayton Warfolk wonders whether the street's special character will survive.
Hi, Patrick, it's Andy.
It's been 5 months since Andy Ross closed the doors to Cody's Books, the most famous bookstore on Berkeley's most famous street.
Closing down Cody's on Telegraph was a heartbreaking experience for me, and clearly for many people in the community.
Two other Cody's remain open in the Bay Area, but it was the shop on the corner of Telegraph and Haste, recently leased to a Halloween store, that earned Cody's its reputation as a haven for activists, intellectuals, and legendary characters during the 60s. The bookstore is only the latest business on Telegraph to fall on hard times.
Well, the Adidas store here is brand new.
City officials, like the mayor's chief of staff, Cisco DeVries, hope to reverse that trend.
We've got a 30,000 students, we've got 15,000 staff and faculty, we've got a great neighborhood here, we've got transit. There's no reason this shouldn't be a thriving avenue.
When Cody's closed, Mayor Tom Bates pledged $250,000 to clean up what some complain has become a squalid and crime-ridden street. In some ways, the plan is working. Pete's Coffee is among a handful of new chain stores to open on Telegraph. But that means direct competition with businesses founded in the street's heyday, like the Mediterranean Cafe.
Cap to go, please.
The Med opened a year after Cody's. New owner Craig Becker intends to mend what he calls 50 years of deferred maintenance.
What we would like it to become is what it was in the 60s and the 70s in the sense that it's a meeting place. But we don't want to just turn it into a museum of what the Med used to be either. We want to make it appeal to people for today as well.
But for many, it's difficult not to be nostalgic.
Is it hard to see other businesses, the Halloween store, in that space?
Yes. I wish that... I wish it was otherwise.
This is Clayton Warfolk for CNS News.
At the Oakland Zoo, they use an ancient alternative medicine to give animals, like zebras, a better quality of life.
And as Maryam Anand says, at this rate, the giraffes might have a better health plan than you do.
The Oakland Zoo cares about the well-being of all its animals. But it faces special problems when it comes to caring for its 10 giraffes. Weighing between a half to 1.5 tons, with tall bodies and spindly legs, giraffes defy conventional treatment.
The drugs weren't manufactured for exotics. They were manufactured for and tested on horses, cows, goats, sheep, rabbits, guinea pigs, dogs, and cats. Part of exotic animal medicine is taking that kind of gamble on stuff.
Amy and other zoo officials are gambling on safer approaches, which include Eastern and holistic medicine, like the Tellington Touch Massage.
We use T-Touch to literally teach them that it's not a life-threatening experience to be touched. So we'll do the big, firm tiger touches like this.
At 18 years old, Tiki is a middle-aged giraffe with bone spurs in her ankles and arthritis. T-Touch improves her circulation, but she still suffers from stress and pain. So Amy called in Dr. Jenny Taylor, a veterinary acupuncturist. Jenny is treating Tiki's shoulder, where muscles have atrophied due to the uneven gait caused by her sore feet. Jenny says it's all related.
Instead of just using acupuncture like a drug or a surgical procedure to make the animals feel better, we really are trying to, again, look at the animal as a whole and try to promote overall wellness instead of just dealing with one problem at a time.
These methods are not only for the elderly. Surgically fusing 5-year-old Coyote's ankle saved his life, but acupuncture and T-Touch have kept him active and healthy. With such success, the Oakland Zoo is committed to using alternative medicine whenever it helps. This is Mariam Anand with CNS News.
Kind of their tongues and their lips act in the same manner that a human hand does. So they can just grab their food and they can actually wrestle the tongue and mouth over big thorny things, thorns that would be as big as a human thumb. They can wrangle with their tongue-mouth system because their lips are prehensile, which means that they just, they fold over and grip.
And that's it for this edition of CNS News. I'm Pauline Bartoloni.
And I'm Larry Santana. Thanks for watching. And remember, you can keep up with the stories we're covering anytime. Just Google Northgate News online.
Good night.